me, Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, June 14th, 2018. It's Flag Day. You can wave it around. And I think it's the birthday of our dear tweeter. And the Inspector General of the Justice Department delivered quite a gift to him. This is the Justice Department's Inspector General, who's been working for more than a year investigating the investigations of James Comey's FBI into Hillary Clinton's email server and the related issues. And the Inspector General issued a 500-page report. And I want to be clear, I have not had a chance to review it. I'm working from initial news accounts, and certainly there may be more in this report than what we're able to share with you today. But based on these initial reports, the big takeaways for me is that the Inspector General didn't even touch the content of Hillary Clinton's emails. The purview was limited to whether the server was legit, whether it was containing classified information. But it appears that he skirted around the issues of pay-for-play that were exposed in some of Hillary Clinton's emails, the collaboration between members of the Clinton Foundation, Doug Band, its leader, and employees of the government who worked for Hillary at the State Department. And we know that big donors to the Clinton Foundation got access to Hillary Clinton, often on a very short notice basis. Secondly, the report doesn't note something that has been reported before, that Peter Strzok, he spells his name S-T-R-O-Z-K, the FBI agent, a top investigator at the agency, that he reportedly drafted James Comey's statement clearing Hillary Clinton of wrongdoing with the lecture about carelessness and those comments. It was written well before the FBI interviewed her. And I think that deserves some further investigation. And perhaps that is buried in the 500-page report. But at this point, I have no indication that those important subjects were considered. Now, the Inspector General castigated former FBI Director St. James Comey, saying that he's guilty of insubordination. Other senior bureau officials showed a willingness to take official action to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president. But at the same time, he found no evidence that the conclusions by department prosecutors were affected by bias or other improper considerations. The report acknowledges that certain emails appear to contain classified information, but they tossed that aside. Investigators determined the FBI's conclusion that Clinton didn't intend to expose classified information was legitimate. Now, I'm sorry. This is carving out a special exception for a former Secretary of State because intention is not a factor in the mishandling of classified information. And other people have been penalized, even earning jail time, for less egregious violations. So these are already examples of how the Clinton side and the Trump side we'll be able to cherry-pick from this report details that are going to be the subject of tweets for days to come. Yes, a flurry, if not a blizzard, of tweets from one side and the other, I think can be predicted. So Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General, used the term insubordination for Comey, saying that he flouted Justice Department practices when he decided only he had the authority and credibility to make key decisions and speak for the Justice Department. He says Comey made a serious error of judgment in sending a letter to Congress on October 28, announcing he was reopening the investigation of Clinton's use of the server. And he called it extraordinary that Comey assessed that it was best for him not to speak directly with either the Attorney General or a Deputy Attorney General about his decision beforehand. Now, on this issue, I tend to lean toward Comey's side. Loretta Lynch went passive after the exposure of her Phoenix airport meeting, when Bill Clinton's jet nuzzled up to her jet and they had a little talk about their grandkids? Well, she didn't formally recuse herself. But she did step back and say she wouldn't be involved in a decision and she would stand by a decision that was reached. So she left a vacuum and Comey stepped into it. Now, in hindsight, I think you can be critical, and I'm no fan of Jim Comey's. But on that particular issue, I think that he didn't have any real good choices. Now, the report also said that some senior bureau officials exhibited a disturbing willingness to take official action to hurt Trump's chances to become president. And they revealed a text message that we hadn't heard about before from Peter Stroke to his girlfriend. Apparently, they were both married at the time. And this is the woman named Lisa Page, an attorney at the FBI. And they had an exchange where Page said, Trump's not ever going to become president, right? Right? And Stroke said, no, he won't. We'll stop it. Now, we lack context here. Was this a professional communication, or was this private musings, the opinions of people in their off hours? Now, they were having a personal relationship, and so to consider this to be a private communication, to me, is not a stretch. But I don't know enough to really conclude that. And Jim Comey hit the tweeter today. I respect the IG office, which is why I urge them to do this review. The conclusions are reasonable, even though I disagree with some. People of good faith can see an unprecedented situation differently. I pray no director faces it again. Thanks to IG's people for hard work. So, this report, while it does have a few dramatic statements, it drops back into bureaucratic language pretty quickly here. And this is the voice that often comes out of Washington. Mistakes were made, the statement says. The Bureau admitted to errors of judgment, violations of or disregard for policy, or, when viewed with the benefit of hindsight, simply not the best courses of action. But then, the conclusion, they were not in any respect the result of bias or improper considerations. I find that hard to believe. Very hard. So we've got Democrats like Gerald Nadler of New York. The stark conclusion we draw after reviewing this report is that the FBI's actions helped Donald Trump become president. And on the other side, Daryl Issa said that this is a damning indictment of former Director Comey and the Department of Justice's mishandling of the investigation. And regarding Stroke's text, the Inspector General said that it's not only indicative of a biased state of mind, but even more seriously, implies a willingness to take official action to impact the presidential candidate's electoral prospects. The messages potentially indicated or created the appearance that investigative decisions were impacted by bias or improper considerations. The report also raises questions about how the FBI handled Andrew McCabe, his recusal when his wife was running for political office in Virginia and accepted contributions from Terry McAuliffe. And this has been one of Trump's misleading claims all along, that somehow Andy McCabe was paid off by Terry McAuliffe, who was acting as a bag man for the Clintons. Now, Terry McAuliffe has a long history of working as a bag man for the Clintons, but here his self-interest was at stake. He was trying to get a Democrat elected to the legislature in Virginia. And it happened in 2015. And so I think that this is carelessness on the part of the Inspector General handing another lit firecracker to Donald Trump. Now, the report doesn't identify these individuals, but five officials with some connection to the email probe were found to be expressing political views, and the IG faults them for having brought discredit to themselves, sowed doubt about the FBI's handling of the mid-year investigation, and impacted the reputation of the FBI. There's also some criticism of the FBI office in New York, and this goes to when Anthony Weiner's laptop was discovered to have Hillary Clinton emails on it. And the field office in New York quickly assessed the situation and then slow-walked it, according to the Inspector General, because by the end of September, the Bureau had learned virtually every fact it would cite as justification a month later to search Weiner's laptop. But they said, oh, we don't have a warrant, and, you know, they made it seem like it was impossible to investigate that fully. Then, after Comey authorized that, they turned around in, what, 5 or 6 days and said, oh, we've analyzed all of it and there's no problem. Forget we mentioned it. So my bottom line is that James Comey is due criticism and perhaps even some accountability for his actions as FBI director. And they go well beyond the Clinton email and Trump-Russia investigations. But we'll never go into the way he railroaded people into federal prison, from John Kiriakou to Sterling at the CIA, Jeffrey Sterling. Not to mention the handling of the media leak cases Risen and Rosen, the deployment of thousands of paid informants, Comey's bungling of the investigation into the San Bernardino shooting couple, and the fake demand to hack into that iPhone. James Comey has a litany of failures, but most of them are excluded from the focus of the Inspector General's report and will never be examined. The other contention from the report is, this is a complete quote, I gave you a partial one before, "We found no evidence that the conclusions by department prosecutors were affected by bias or other improper considerations. Rather, we concluded that they were based on the prosecutor's assessment of facts, the law, and past department practice. Our review did not find evidence to connect the political views expressed in the text messages to the specific investigative decisions that we reviewed." And those are bureaucratic weasel words, in my humble opinion. I'll dig more into this and, as the time permits, comment further as this report becomes more readily available. And Andy McCabe, who I mentioned, has filed a lawsuit against the Justice Department and the FBI for his firing just a few months ago. As you know, he was hours away from retirement, would have received a pension, when Jeff Sessions decided to fire him on March 16th. And the Justice Department is accused of failing to share the documents and the policy basis for the firing of Andy McCabe, and so he's gone to court. Aaron Mattei appeared on our podcast a while back. He writes occasionally for The Nation and also hosts programs on The Real News. And at The Nation yesterday, he posted a great story. Looking back at year one of the Mueller investigation, the headline reads, "The Mueller indictments still don't add up to collusion." And in a careful review of the indictments to date and the actions of the special counsel, he notes there are 5 guilty pleas, 20 indictments, 100 charges, but none of these have anything to do with Mueller's chief focus, the Russian government's alleged meddling in the 2016 election and suspected involvement by the Trump campaign. Mattei allows that it's possible that Mueller will make new indictments that go to the core of his case, but what's been revealed so far does not make a compelling brief for collusion. So he recaps the Manafort and Gates indictments, which are related to their work for Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine. And he adds a new detail here, that it's generally believed because Yanukovych went to exile in Moscow after the U.S.-backed coup, that he is tied to the Kremlin. But Manafort pressed Yanukovych, while he was in power, to sign an agreement with the European Union to link the country closer to the West, which was diametrically opposed to the Kremlin's agenda. But we don't hear about that because, you know, that's inconvenient to the Trump-Russia narrative. Then the most recent indictment of Konstantin Kalimnik, who is described by Mueller as tied to Russian intelligence. Well, the evidence supporting that assertion is sealed. We know about Mike Flynn and the wiretaps of his conversations he lied about, but in the wiretaps, it didn't indicate that he had crossed a line in his conversation with the Russians. Then Mattei recaps George Papadopoulos, his guilty plea for lying to the FBI, the exposure of Crossfire Hurricane that includes the informant, Cambridge professor Stefan Halper, an American with a dirty record of interfering in elections going back to the Reagan campaign of 1980. And he says that with Papadopoulos, the possibility is that Papadopoulos was told about stolen Democratic emails before the theft was publicly known. But we know that there was all this talk about the emails that Hillary's staff had deleted before they were printed out and shipped back to the State Department. And so it's entirely possible that what they were talking about was not secret, and that Russian hacking of those emails would not have been a big surprise. I'm not saying that it happened. I'm only saying that it is not the big deal that it's been made out to be. Then when we get to the St. Petersburg-based Internet Research Agency, the indictment of 13 Russians and three companies by Mueller, and he never expected any of them to show up in court, our next story relates to that. And Mattei comments, prominent media and political voices have portrayed the ads from the Internet Research Agency as a major component of a, quote, sophisticated Russian interference campaign. James Clapper, the former CIA director, has declared that, actually he was the former director of National Intelligence, let me correct myself, declared that taken together the Russian ads and stolen Democratic emails handed Trump the presidency. But we know that half of those paid ads didn't run until after the election, and they were all pretty lame. They really didn't have a direct impact on the election, and it's only people who've never looked at them who believe that. Well, maybe not only, but a lot of them. So then Mattei says, Mueller has yet to indict anyone, let alone any Russian, for Russiagate's underlying crime, the theft of Democratic Party emails, and the allegation that they were given to WikiLeaks. And more than a year after they accused the Russian government of carrying it out, intelligence officials have yet to provide a shred of proof. Well said, Aaron Mattei. I've linked to his article in the show file for today's podcast. So here is Bloomberg News from June the 12th, 2 days ago. U.S. Special Counsel Mueller warned that Russian intelligence services still have active interference operations into U.S. elections, and that handing over evidence in a criminal case could imperil ongoing investigations. So you just get Mueller's side of the story from this Bloomberg report. And they describe this company called Concord, based in St. Petersburg, is the only defendant to respond in court to the indictment pleading not guilty on May 9th. And for that Russiagate smear, the firm is controlled by Yevgeny Prigozhin, a Russian caterer who is close to Putin. It provides food services to the Kremlin. So it pretty much leaves it at that. But if you go to Zero Hedge, which is a generally sympathetic outlet to Donald Trump, they point out that Mueller is scrambling to limit that evidence, and he asked for and was denied a delay in the trial or the proceedings related to Concord Management and Consulting, LLC. And it appears he never expected one of these Russian indicted companies to step forward and to battle it out with him. But they are within their rights to demand sharing of the evidence. It's called discovery. And Mueller is using the smokescreen of potential meddling in this year's elections to claim that we have to keep all this secret from the people he has indicted. And I think that this is ludicrous. And it shows that these are simply publicity stunts on Mueller's part. He's really serious about pursuing the people who meddled in the election. He would be indicting or subpoenaing Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of the great state of Kansas. The slime, sleaze, and corruption of the Trump family knows no limits. We have another example as the New York State Attorney General's Office completed its investigation into the Trump Foundation, accusing the charity and the family of sweeping violations of campaign finance laws, self-dealing, and illegal coordination with the presidential campaign. And in a lawsuit which seeks to dissolve the foundation and bar Trump and the kids, Don, Eric, and Ivanka, from serving on nonprofit boards, is an extraordinary rebuke of a sitting president. And the Attorney General also sent referral letters to the IRS and the Federal Election Commission for possible further action. And they have demanded a couple of $1 million in repayment to the foundation. And they expose that during the 16 presidential campaign, campaign manager Corey Lewandowski was able to direct expenditures from the foundation, even though that is explicitly prohibited. And they list a series of questionable payments that Trump made from the foundation to settle business and personal disputes. And there we have it. Every day I stop for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscription money. People like Benny Alto up in Oregon, Arlene Montemurano, I think she's in the D.C. area, Aiden McAleer, Auntie Lundberg, thank you for your support. And I'm marking 9 years of podcasting this month. I'm looking for 9 new subscribers, and next week I'm going to announce an exciting new bonus gift for people who take out an annual subscription. So if you're angling for that, we'll have the announcement maybe on Tuesday. But in the meantime, there's nothing stopping you. From clicking on over to peterbcollins.com, you find the menu tab, you click on Become a Subscriber, land on the sign-up page, and in a couple of minutes, you can choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. If you're allergic to PayPal, yo comprende. You can communicate with me at my P.O. Box, Box 150660, San Rafael, California, 94915. That's Box 150660, San Rafael, zip code 94915. Yesterday, I led the podcast with a soundbite from Senator Bob Corker, the lame duck from Tennessee, chiding his fellow Republicans who are scared shitless of what he called poking the bear, upsetting Trump. And this has led to Republican on Republican fighting. Lindsey Graham yesterday took up spats with 2 different senators, Mike Lee of Utah and Bob Corker, the poke the bear guy. With Mike Lee, who is trying to do something good, he wants to amend the annual defense bill to remove Obama's biggest blunder, well, just one of them, the National Defense Authorization Act's detention and trial charge, that's a clause, from the 2012 NDAA. And Mike Lee is this conservative Republican from Utah, but he wants to amend that to protect Americans from detention without charge or trial. It's one of the rare things I agree with Mike Lee on. But at the lunch, Graham accused Lee of pressing for the amendment to raise money. Mike Lee snapped back, like hell I'm doing that. And then Graham and Corker got into an expletive-laced exchange over his poke the bear comments. Behind this is a battle over trade-related issues. Pat Toomey, who is an extreme conservative Republican from Pennsylvania, he's got a bill to require greater oversight of deals between foreign and U.S. firms, think Monsanto and Bayer. He wants those to be subjected to a Senate vote. But most of his colleagues deserted him, and the proposal went down in flames on a 62-35 vote. Meanwhile, 2 senators, Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, and Claire McCaskill, Democrat from Missouri, have sent a letter to the White House after a report last week that the internal analysis of the economic team at the White House is that Trump's war on trade is going to dampen economic growth and could even lead to a recession. So, Johnson and McCaskill have asked the economic advisors to send over their research so they can review it. And Gary Cohn, who used to run Trump's economic council, said yesterday in Washington that he's already seeing signs that companies are holding back on investment out of fears of a trade war, and that a tit-for-tat tariff exchange could negate the economic benefits of Trump's tax cuts. I think that's already happened. A couple of international stories for you. Saudi-led forces, supported by the U.S., have begun an assault on the critical port in Yemen, Hodeida, and this could cut off food supplies to a nation that is already on the verge of mass starvation. The population is 27 million, and about a third of those people don't know where their next meal is coming from. And the U.S. maintains that it's just helping Saudi Arabia with some reconnaissance on sites that they shouldn't hit and blah, blah, blah. But I don't believe that. And separately, we continue a skirmish against Al-Qaeda that's on a covert basis in Yemen today. Nicaragua's embattled leader Daniel Ortega is now facing a general strike of 24 hours. Demands coming from every sector that he step down. There is a civil alliance of Ortega critics, including students, religious leaders, and business people, and they are demanding the peaceful exit of Ortega and his unpopular wife and vice president, Rosario Murillo. And one of the leaders, a 22-year-old student, Valeska Valle, or Valle, said, "We know the national strike will not be decisive in overthrowing this government, but it is a way of applying pressure to end the massacre. And at least 148 people have been killed by security forces or masked members of shadowy paramilitary gangs since the protests began in April." At the United Nations, the U.S. and Israel successfully blocked a Security Council resolution condemning the State of Israel for the violent deaths of Palestinians protesting in Gaza over the last 10 weeks. Well, the General Assembly did the deed yesterday, and they passed this resolution, which deplored excessive use of force by Israel, requested recommendations to protect Palestinians. It did not explicitly criticize Hamas, which Israel claims has used these protesters basically as a human shield to fight Israel. And I think that is a pretty weak argument based on the evidence that we've seen. Now, Danny Danon, predictably the Israeli ambassador, immediately called this anti-Semitic. Quote, "This type of worldwide assault is reserved only for Israel. It is not a criticism. It is not difference in opinion or policy. It is anti-Semitism." And that shows the reflexive move by Israel. Whenever they are criticized on a valid basis, they respond that the criticism is anti-Semitic, that it's hate speech aimed at Jews, not human rights speech aimed at the State of Israel. And the effort to silence critics extends right here to the liberal Bay Area. And Glenn Greenwald today writes about the executive director of the San Francisco chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Her name is Zahra Ballou. She's a lawyer, longtime civil rights activist, and she was notified a couple of months ago that she would be honored by an interfaith grassroots organization called People Acting in Community Together, or PACT. So they announced the award, they set up the fundraising dinner, and then supporters of Israel weighed in. They threatened PACT's executive director, saying that you might not get our donations if you move forward. And so then they tried to split the baby. They went to Ballou and said, "Well, should we have a dialogue circle? Can we honor the organization without naming you specifically?" And Ballou refused on the ground that they'd already publicly announced the award and that pro-Israel groups had no right to dictate which Muslim leaders are acceptable and which ones are not. And to Ballou's credit, she has refused to allow this PACT group to save face at her expense and gone public with this ugly, sordid episode. Here in San Francisco, the least progressive candidate for mayor has won the ranked choice voting outcome. It took over 2 weeks to count all the ballots. It was a very narrow victory, about 1,500 votes, for London Breed. Now, she's the first African-American woman to be mayor of San Francisco, and I will be supporting her. But I didn't support her in the election. She stepped out early after Mayor Ed Lee died last December, and under the city charter, she was the temporary mayor. But then they selected an interim mayor who was not aligned with either with any of the potential candidates, and the San Francisco Chronicle declared that London Breed was a victim of progressive politics. And this is extending the effort by the San Francisco leading newspaper, The Chronicle. Willie Brown, our former mayor, is a columnist. He's got a weekly column on Sundays in the paper. And since Willie Brown was mayor, he has ensured that progressives get locked out every time there is an opening for the top job at City Hall. And this progressive prevention campaign is aided and abetted by a billionaire investor in tech named Ron Conway. And there was Ron in this election running negative messaging against the most qualified candidate, Mark Leno, an out gay state senator who has served at every level. He was a San Francisco legislator, then he went to Sacramento. He is heads and shoulders above London Breed in experience and in leadership. But because he was not the darling of the tech community and the rich people in San Francisco, he was edged out in what was not a fair campaign. And as I wrap up today, a couple of quickies from the Me Too file. L.A. prosecutors say their sex crimes team is reviewing a case against actor Sylvester Stallone, who denies allegations that he was involved in an incident of sexual misconduct in the 1990s. The defense of the actor is that the woman who made the complaint had had a consensual relationship with Stallone. And this gets a little complicated, but Dr. Luke has denied a claim made by the singer Kesha that he sexually assaulted Katy Perry. Kesha sent a text to Lady Gaga in 2016 alleging that Dr. Luke, the producer, had assaulted Katy Perry. Apparently Perry denies it. According to a statement from the producer, Katy Perry herself confirmed that Dr. Luke did not rape her. Kesha's accusation to the contrary is baseless, irresponsible, and they're seeking $50 million in compensation. And finally today, Eric Thomas is a man I have great respect for. He was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, and he gave me a very powerful and honest interview last August. If you haven't heard it, look it up at peterbcollins.com. He was drummed out of the Air Force Academy just weeks before graduation because he had served willingly as an undercover investigator for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And he was successful. His work resulted in 25 investigations, 15 drug convictions, and 3 sexual assault convictions. And that so embarrassed the management of the Air Force Academy that they used the pretext of demerits that were earned while he was doing his undercover investigations had to cost him his commission. And there's an article at Town Hall that updates the story and suggests that if you want to support Eric Thomas, contact the Secretary of the Air Force, Heather Wilson, Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, or the dear tweeter in the White House. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. I hope you'll share it far and wide. You can find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.